Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today we talk about the culture wars. If you paid any attention to the news media over the past few decades, you've heard of them. On the one side, you have those standing for traditionalism, religiosity, and family values, holding back the onslaught of debauchery. On the other side, there are the forces of progressivism, pushing society ever forward into higher levels of tolerance, inclusion, and more enlightened understanding. In recent years, the battleground has come in the form of same-sex marriage, abortion, the legalization of marijuana, and a few other topics that fall under the rubric of social issues. While this social strife may appear new to the younger crowd, in reality, the United States has been embroiled regularly in such cultural conflict. Religious fundamentalists have routinely been engaged in a struggle against the forces of carnal secularism. And to make that point, as well as to help us to possibly understand our current cultural context in the light of our nation's history, I'm pleased to have on the program Professor Barry Hankins, author of the delightfully named book, Jesus and Gin, Evangelicalism, the Roaring Twenties, and Today's Culture Wars, published by Palgrave Macmillan Press. Dr. Hankins is a professor of history at Baylor University, and Jesus and Gin is not the only book he has penned. Barry has also recently published Francis Schaeffer and the Shaping of Evangelical America, American Evangelicals, a Contemporary History of a Mainstream Religious Movement, The Second Great Awakening and the Transcendentalist, plus a few others which we will link to on our website. He is currently working on a book on Baptist history with a former guest on our show, Thomas Kidd. Barry also serves as a scholar at Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast, and I had the pleasure of meeting him recently in Indianapolis at a conference on religious liberty during the American founding. Barry, welcome to Research on Religion.
It's good to be here, Tony.
So, Jesus and Gin, huh? What a great name for a book. I have to ask, though, given that Baylor's a dry campus and the Southern Baptists are known for discouraging the partaking of the adult beverages, did you get any hassle from your administration or from your colleagues when you came up with the name of that book?
No, not at all. Baylor also, fortunately, is well known for academic freedom, and so I think everyone got a little bit of a chuckle out of the title, but no resistance whatsoever. I have had some people who thought the book was totally about prohibition and really only one chapter is about prohibition.
But. Yeah, that's, when that book came across my desk, too, I said, oh, prohibition, that would be a great topic. And then as I looked into it, it really covers a wide range of topics that we often forget about occurring in the 1920s, and something we'll get to. Did you get to pick the title of that book, or did the publisher foist that onto you?
It's a little bit of both. I actually wanted the title to be Jesus, Gin, and Jazz.
Ooh.
And then the subtitle. But the my publisher, my editor, thought that it was a little too much of a mouthful, Jesus, Gin, and Jazz. I thought the jazz would have made it clear that the book was not just about prohibition, but anyway, I gave in on that one, and so we cut it to Jesus and Gin, and then the subtitle that you read just a moment ago.
Yeah, I would have liked the Jesus, Gin, and Jazz. It is a lot of alliteration there. However, you would have got the music lover crowd.
Exactly.
Right? And there are a lot of things going on there in the 1920s that we will discuss, not only jazz, but a lot of other things. Let me ask you this. What possessed you to write this book?
Well, it actually, when I was, you mentioned the book American Evangelicals that I wrote, came out in, I think, 2008. When I was writing that book, which really is kind of an overview of history of evangelicals in the 20th century, evangelicals and fundamentalists. And when I was writing that book, when I was writing on the 20s and the controversies, the fundamentalist and liberal controversies that were going on, I started thinking about how similar some of that sounded to things in what I call our own time. Now, I define our own time as 1980 to the present for whatever, you know. And I have some reasons for doing that we can talk about later. But and so I started thinking about how the 20s and our own time had these similar sort of religious conflicts within religious denominations, but also conflict between religious people on the one hand and the secular culture on the other. And so when I was kind of casting about, after I wrote American Evangelicals, I think I wrote the Francis Schaeffer biography, and I was thinking about another book to do, and I sort of pitched this idea to a guy that then took the idea, an agent that then took the idea to Palgrave Macmillan, and they liked it, and so I was kind of off and running from that point.
Yeah, that's a cool story, how our research agendas always kind of prompt us to do other things. And you're right, as I read this book, I keep thinking about our current era and how many similar historical trends that we're experiencing that we oftentimes think about as brand new things really occurred back in the 1920s. The names and places might be a little bit different, but the general themes are there. Now, the payoff of your book is the concluding chapter entitled How the Roaring Twenties Set the Stage for the Culture Wars of Our Own Time. And we're going to get to that theme at the end of our interview, but I think it's important to discuss what the culture wars of the 1920s were all about. And that was a long time ago, nearly a century ago. And many of us youngins, you know, may not know all the details. You might have been around there, you know, finding out on the ground what was going on. Were you around at the time?
The 1920s?
Yeah.
No, I'm not quite that old. I was born in the 50s. So.
Okay. Well, the 1920s, that era basically came at the end of a big period of dramatic transformation in American society that more or less encompassed the turning of the 19th into the 20th century. If you could survey the socioeconomic landscape for us, what was going on in the country for the, say, two or three decades leading up to the 1920s?
Yeah. Well, if you take the period from 1877 to about 1920, you know, we call this in history, we call this the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era. And the Gilded Age was really about industrialization. It's the era from 1877 on into the early 20th century when America was transformed from a largely agrarian, you know, agricultural, farming, rural sort of society with those sorts of values, often known as kind of Jeffersonian values in some ways, his ideal for America. And it was really transformed into an industrial country with big business and factories. And, you know, the steel industry was one of the earliest ones. And then by the time you get to the 1920s, you're all the way into the beginning of the auto industry is starting up in the teens and 20s, really starting to flourish. And then everything that goes with all that sort of thing. Even the population, you know, was shifting from maybe 80% rural and 20% urban in 1880 to almost flipping that by the 1920s. And then as you move through the 20th century, you know, the rural population gets smaller and smaller, and the cities get bigger and bigger. So along with this industrialization, there's also this urbanization, the move to the cities, and there's immigration. And the immigration is, of course, America is, you know, is a nation of immigrants. But in that period, 1877 and 1920, the immigration began to change from sort of northern European Protestants to more southern European, eastern European, often Catholics, Jews, other non-Protestants coming in. And so this caused a lot of cultural conflict and cultural change as well. You know, you throw in the women's suffrage movement, women gaining the right to vote in 1920, that movement had been underway for a long time. That's going on. And you have also religious revivals and religious conflict going on between fundamentalists and liberals in Protestant denominations and so forth. And then one last thing is this whole era from 1900 to 1920 is known as the Progressive Era, where you have this tremendous era of reform, where you have a lot of Protestants of various stripes, everything from fairly evangelical to quite liberal, and then you have some somewhat secular sorts of people all calling for reform of society having to do with workers' rights, labor unions, the power of labor over against the owners of industry, women, as I said, women's suffrage, and then a topic I'm sure you'll want to get to, prohibition of alcoholic beverages. I mean, all of these sorts of reforms were in the works in the first couple of decades of the 20th century.
Yeah, a lot of social and political change is occurring here. And you mentioned urbanization, too. It's phenomenal just to think how quickly our society urbanized from 1880 to 1920. 40 years may sound like a long time to a 20-year-old, but a lot of things stirring up. And I'm sure there shows it sows a lot of confusion culturally in what's going on. Now, as you just mentioned, prohibition, that's probably the one thing in the 1920s, the big event that focuses the cultural contradictions of the time, or at least it's one of the big frontline battles of the culture war, prohibition. Everybody knows that stuff. The 1920s were the years, or was the decade, where demon rum was illegal. And yet, as you title in the subtitle of your book, it was known as the Roaring Twenties, when everybody was basically boozing it up and dancing the Charleston. So what's going on with this prohibition that, on the one hand, it's illegal, but on the other hand, you take a look at the painting that is on the cover of your book, and it's all about booze and dancing and living it up in the high life.
Yeah. Well, you know, the prohibition movement, you know, it goes all the way back to the temperance movement of the 19th century. And so if you roll the clock back to 1820s and 1830s, I mean, America was going through the Second Great Awakening, a period of intense revivalism going on. And a lot of reform movements came out of the revivals of the Second Great Awakening in the 1820s and 1830s and into the 40s, into the mid-19th century. And one of those reform movements was the temperance movement. Essentially, when the temperance movement began, it was meant to tackle excessive use of alcohol because, believe it or not, the excessive use of alcohol was much worse then than it is even in our own time, as best we can tell. This is really hard to do, but those who've studied this and tried to come up with statistics for what, you know, how much alcohol Americans were consuming, as best we can tell, probably the height of per capita consumption of alcohol in America was somewhere around the 1820s or 1830s in terms of per, you know, gallons per year per person. So drinking in America, it was part of the reason was it was difficult at times to find other beverages to drink. You, at the time, they had trouble keeping milk from spoiling. Pasteurization had not really kicked in yet. Water supplies were often unhealthy as well. So Sometimes workers would, you know, drink during the job, supplied by their bosses and so forth. So this temperance movement meant to tackle that and started encouraging people to scale back voluntarily, and then it moved from that into laws that actually began to outlaw alcohol.
Yeah, one of the interesting things in your book was that you bring in this, you know, how drunk America was in the early 19th century. We oftentimes think of it as an era of Victorian frugality or Victorian sensibilities, but just for the basic reasons you mentioned, water was brackish, you couldn't store other beverages, but alcohol kept. And that's what you drank. And you even noted a few studies in your own book that the United States actually consumed more liquor than many of the places in Europe we consider to be the big drinking countries.
Yeah.
So go USA, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's partly the frontier phenomenon, too. As people moved out on the frontier, there was less sort of social and church development and social institutions. And so it was a kind of a wide-open frontier mentality. And this seemed to contribute to excessive drinking. Interestingly, the temperance movement, even when it was in its stages of just calling for voluntary, you know, preachers and others going around urging people to cut back on drinking, we think that the per capita consumption of alcohol dropped significantly from about 1820 to 1850. But one of the points I make in the book is that the temperance leaders may not have known how well they were actually doing. And so it was about the 1850s that they went from calling for voluntary cutting back on drinking to actually calling for state laws that would outlaw the sale, manufacture, and sale of alcoholic beverages. And they became known as the Maine laws because the first one that we know of was in the state of Maine. And so starting in the 1850s, you had a temperance movement kind of morphing into a prohibition movement, and then it grew in strength throughout the rest of the century and into the early 20th century.
One of the interesting things that I've learned over time is how this prohibition movement was linked to the suffragette movement, women's right to vote. How is that linked?
Well, it's one of the most significant things about prohibition that is usually forgotten when it's kind of trotted out for purposes in our own time for this and that, is that Prohibition was not a movement of fundamentalists. It actually was a broad reform movement, and fundamentalists got on board with it, and evangelicals, and you know, it was difficult to tell who was a fundamentalist, who was an evangelical at that time in history, but what came to be known as fundamentalists, I mean, they got on board with it, but they actually were not necessarily the leaders of it. You had the more mainline sort of denominations that were going through theological transitions that were very reform-minded. They were behind it. You had secular progressives who really weren't that religious. They were behind Prohibition. There was it was a broad-based reform movement, and many of the leaders of it were women, and not all by any means, but almost all of the women who were involved in temperance and Prohibition were also involved in the suffragette movement to gain voting rights for women. So these movements, they were all part of a broad sort of reform emphasis of the progressive era, and Prohibition was one of them.
That's right. If the women get the right to vote, they're going to vote away the booze from the guys.
Exactly. Yeah. That was one of the views, yeah.
Yeah. Now, we get Prohibition by the late, the 1910s, and then takes effect in 1919. You make a very interesting statement at the end of the chapter that you discussed Prohibition, and you touched on this a little bit a minute ago, and I want to read you this passage because it was one of the things that stuck out to me in the book, and I want you to explain what it means. You write, "To say that Prohibition was a failure is to say something that has been believed widely since the 1920s, and it helps Americans make sense of Prohibition's repeal. But whether Prohibition was a failure depends on what one believes it was intended to do." Explain that, because I think that has a lot of relevance for today's cultural wars.
Yeah, I think that the beginning of it, the idea that Prohibition was a failure is correct in one sense, in that it over time in certain areas it was so widely ignored and then unenforced that it was very difficult to maintain as a law. You know, there's this sort of legal theory that you're well familiar with as a political scientist that, you know, law kind of loses its legitimacy when people just refuse to obey the law and refuse to turn their neighbors in for disobeying the law. But on the other hand, if one thinks that Prohibition was to reduce drinking in America, and remember that's what the temperance movement began as, a movement to reduce drinking and bring drinking back into a moderation sort of phase, then you actually could argue that it may have been successful. And again, the statistics, very difficult to know if these statistics are accurate, but the best statistics we have show that, in fact, during the Prohibition era, there was a lot less drinking. And it was probably because in many areas of the country, it was difficult to get alcohol. Now, it was not in New York City, but it was in a lot of medium-sized towns out in the Midwest. And so, in fact, if these reformers, if you put yourself into the kind of mindset of an early 20th century Prohibition reformer who's really interested in trying to reduce alcohol consumption because it contributed so much to the dissolution of families, to abuse within families, and especially it led to abuse of women and children, then, you know, you could actually make a case that Prohibition reduced those problems because it did make it more difficult for people to drink, and many people were drinking, and it seems that overall in the United States drinking was reduced from, say, 1890 to, say, 1925, the middle of the Prohibition era. So it all depends on one's perspective. I'm not advocating Prohibition when I say that by any means. I'm just trying to raise an interesting point about how we often look at the past in very simplistic sort of terms, and just whatever the most simple interpretation that helps whatever political agenda we're pushing in our own time, we tend to grab onto that and say, well, look here, it's real clear. And I'm just saying, well, it's not that clear. It's kind of a complex sort of situation.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the issues that we're wrangling with here, especially in the state of Washington, we just legalized marijuana, the simplistic view of Prohibition always comes up. And people say, well, you know, Prohibition didn't work, therefore, you know, why bother with these laws? And it's marijuana today, and who knows what it'll be the next day, the next year, and such and such. So very interesting chapter on that. One of the other issues you deal with or one of the characteristics of the 1920s culture wars was how it became distilled, and there is somewhat of a pun intended there, in a few what we might call media superstars. This was more or less the beginning of the media superstar era. I mean, granted, there's always been looming figures in American history. You had your George Whitfields, you had your Stephen Douglases, to use, you know, religious and secular examples, but what you have the advent of radio, you have moving pictures, and you have the increasing ability to concentrate more urbanized populations into these large theaters and stadiums. And you seem to be on the verge of getting what we might now call our first televangelists or mega church pastors, for lack of better terms. And one of the folks was this guy who comes up regularly in your discussion, including in the Prohibition chapter, this guy named Billy Sunday. Who is this guy, and what impact does he have, or did he have, on the religious landscape at the time?
Well, you talk about a media star. Oftentimes, we think of media stars in our own time. They're, you know, either in film or in athletics, and or in religion. We have our mega churches today. Well, Billy Sunday bridged that gap. His first career was as a Major League Baseball player. So he comes out of rural Iowa. He gets discovered. He plays on a little town team when he's growing up. They had each of these towns in Iowa would have their own baseball teams, and he gets discovered by the Chicago White Stockings, which is the forerunner. It's the National League team, so it's the forerunner of the Chicago Cubs, and he ends up playing in Major League Baseball in the 1880s into the early 1890s, and has about an 8 or 10 year career. Plays outfield, plays for the White Stockings, and then I think it was the Alleghenies, and then ended up with the Philadelphia Phillies, I think was the last team he played for. And he was a light-hitting, fast-running, base-stealing sort of player. I think his lifetime batting average was about .248, but he stole a lot of bases. And this was before they started keeping base-stealing as a official category. He may have actually held the record at one time for most stolen bases in a year. It's real hard to tell, because they weren't keeping that statistic. But anyway, he has this conversion experience in the 1880s, starts preaching, becomes an ordained Presbyterian preacher, but he really travels and takes up revival preaching in the 1890s and in the first decade of the 20th century. And so, as you were saying, you know, this is an era when starting in the teens, and really not until the 20s do you have radio as being a main focus, but Sunday became this charismatic revivalist who began to go to bigger and bigger cities and have bigger and bigger revivals. And so by the time that World War I is going on, 1914 and 1918, the United States enters in 1917, I mean, he's hitting all of the largest cities in the country. He's holding revival meetings that last for weeks on end. They actually build a tabernacle in each of these cities just for his revivals. Wow. And it can hold thousands of people. And then he preaches day in and day out for weeks on end in, you know, Philadelphia, Boston, New York City. In fact, his biggest and most successful revival was in New York City in 1918. And then he becomes a media star by the teens and 20s, and is one of the well-known people in the United States. And he's basically a fundamentalist revivalist preacher.
And he becomes mixed in with a lot of these culture wars and battles between different aspects of Christianity. So what is his shtick? Is there something that is really getting his craw? We mentioned Prohibition here, but are there, you know, what was his take on Prohibition? What was his influence in that movement? And what other things did he insert himself into in what we call these culture wars?
Yeah. Like all revivalist preachers, I mean, first and foremost, he was all about, you know, winning souls, and that was his main message. But he mixed in so much politics, and this is one of the reasons, and he was so controversial. So mixing in politics with religion and then being a very outspoken controversialist, this is one of the reasons he became so popular. So Prohibition, he would preach these. He had this one sermon he started preaching in 1910 or 1912, and it was entitled Booze. And he would go into how, you know, horrible liquor was, and then he would trot out these heart-wrenching stories of the young man who gets hooked on alcohol, and his mother tries to get him to stop drinking, and he accidentally kills her, and all, you know, and then he's, you know, it's just, you know, all of these stories that he trots out, and then he trots out statistics about Prohibition. But then also he starts trotting out an anti-immigrant sort of message along with this. And he starts to say things like, of course, all of these beer manufacturers, they all come from Germany, and you know what Germany's like because, you know, they're fighting World War One.
Yeah.
So he's saying things like, if you turn something over that's made in Germany, on the back of it, it'll say, you know, made in hell or something like this. You know, all this anti-German stuff is coming out. In fact, one time he was preaching in St. Louis, a heavy German population, and he got going so much a guy jumped up onto the platform, and they ended up going at it with each other in a sort of boxing match for a few minutes before they hauled the guy off and arrested him. So really outspoken on prohibition. And then also, I know you may want to get to these fundamentalist liberal sort of controversies in the denominations, but he really would go after liberals in the Presbyterian and Baptist denominations of the North and speak out very strongly against them as well.
Yeah, we're going to cover that a little bit later, because that's one of the interesting phenomena that occurs. It's not only the battle between the religious and the secularists, but it's also a ferment going on within religious circles as well, and religious groups attacking one another for not being sufficiently religion. We're going to kind of stick with that. One of the interesting things that I noticed with Billy Sunday, though, was how he came to be. I mean, he had his conversion experience, and as you mentioned, he started preaching in the late 19th century, where he's still playing baseball. And it seems to me, and again, thinking about our contemporary times, how his career as a preacher was really promoted by the fact that he was successful in another business, namely athletics. And at this time, too, Major League Athletics is taking off. I mean, you know, 1840s, we never had major athletic leagues. It's, you know, baseball all of a sudden becomes a thing in the late 19th century. It seems that as I was reading this, these religious fundamentalists, these reformers, are finding a way to harness secular movements or people's interest in a secular phenomena, baseball. More and more people in the cities are filling up the stadiums. And, you know, I'm sure at some point in time, Billy Sunday is sitting on second base thinking about taking third and says, yeah, it would be a great audience here. So do you see a little bit more of this religious folks not only reacting to the general culture, but also trying to harness it?
Yeah, and it's interesting that it takes place right about that time. When Billy Sunday was converted and decided he was going to go into preaching, he was still playing baseball, and he may have been able to play a few more years. In fact, he walked away from a pretty good contract in his last few, you know, what essentially became his last year. He could have played a couple of more years. So he actually felt, and this was about 1890 or 1891 or two, he actually felt like he needed to leave baseball to become a preacher. But this era from, say, again, 1890 to 1925 or 30, there was this whole movement going on that historians call muscular Christianity. Mm-hmm. And it was this idea that that Christianity had become too feminized, and to be a Christian was to be viewed as kind of the meeker sort of. And Billy Sunday, and also Theodore Roosevelt, the president of the country, 1901 to 1909, Theodore Roosevelt was part of this. He was more of a kind of moderate Episcopalian person, not an evangelical or a fundamentalist. But there was this idea that manliness and faith and Christianity should go together. This was part of the thrust that made the YMCA successful at the same time. The Young Men's Christian Association was the idea of cultivating manly virtues. And this is very much a sort of Victorian sort of thing. Cultivating manly virtues along with the Christian faith. And so Billy Sunday, he actually, when he would give his call for people to, as they called it, hit the sawdust trail, which meant come down the aisle into the front to be converted, he would often say things like, be a man for Jesus, be a man for your family, come down here and give your life to Christ and find out what it really means to be a man. So this was very much a masculine, muscular sort of faith that was being promoted by these figures like Billy Sunday. He had a lot of people that were like him and that were imitating him in the same way. So the fact that he himself was an athlete, and he was very athletic when he preached. So he would be up there. He would sometimes run up on the stage and slide across the platform like he was sliding into third base.
Wow.
Or he would box, you know, shadow box with the devil, you know, and tell him you've got to knock Satan out. You've got to be a man for God. And then he would also say this with with regard to the fundamentalist movement. You've got to stand up and be a man against these liberal namby-pambies who say the Bible isn't true, you know, and all of this sort of stuff. So it really was a combination of the culture of the time and even the warfare motifs of that era of World War One with fundamentalist Christianity.
Yeah, that resonates with me up here in Seattle. One of the most popular megachurch preachers that has arisen over the past decade or so has been Mark Driscoll of Mars Hill Church. We've had an interview with him in the past, and his message is very much the same. Man up, you know, don't be a sissy, be a man for Jesus. And he actually draws in a lot of these young 20-something single males, which is, you know, astounding with that kind of message. And people say, well, we've never seen this before. And you go, well, yeah, you did about a century ago. So there you have it. You said he had some, you know, Billy Sunday, not surprisingly, any kind of big media phenomena. And this is kind of the big era of media phenomena with radio and moving pictures and all that stuff. You spawn imitators. So did he have a few folks that were similar of nature?
He did. One that I talk about in the book was a guy named Paul Rader. And Rader was a former college football player in the early, kind of late 19th, early 20th century, and then he was a boxer for a long time. And he actually got good enough in boxing that he was a sparring partner for some of the champions of the day. And there was a brief moment in around 1912 or 1913 when the heavyweight champion of the world was Jack Johnson, and Jack Johnson was African American, and so a lot of people were really trying to find a white, you know, a great white hope in the boxing world. This would have been before Joe Louis, the great champion, black champion, and so they first settled on one guy that Paul Rader had been a sparring partner, and for a brief time it appears that they may even tried to promote him. But he was probably a little past his prime. Anyway, he became a preacher. He had a sort of conversion experience. He had grown up a conservative Methodist, but he had gotten away from his faith in a lot of ways. And then in the 19-teens, he had a kind of a reconversion experience, and he became a popular preacher. And he built a big tabernacle in Chicago, and essentially he saw it as a revival center that would facilitate the churches in that area. So he actually wouldn't have Sunday morning services because he didn't want to compete with other churches. Mm. But in the afternoons on Sunday and then throughout the week, people from other churches and denominations would come down to town to the tabernacle, and Rader would preach. And he also had a major radio ministry. And so he also preached this manly, muscular Christianity. There would be photographs of him, fists thrust in the air like a boxing champion. There's one photograph in a mag. He had a magazine that he published, and one photograph had him in a suit and tie and standing in a 3-point stance of, say, like a defensive lineman. And his calls were often as explicit or more so than Billy Sunday's in terms of be a man for Jesus, you know, as a masculine Christianity. He even had fitness as part of his program in his Chicago tabernacle and in his magazine. He promoted athletic fitness, and they had workouts and all sorts of things that would go along with the ministry. So I think he very much was modeling himself in a lot of ways after Billy Sunday.
Yeah, well, if we get a chance, I'll try to remember to put some of these pictures up on our Facebook page, and people can check us out at Research on Religion with Anthony Gill on our Facebook page. Sign up to like us as well, but then also see these pictures of Paul Rader, because again, we tend to think our era is rather unique. The Tim Tebow's of the era was like, oh my gosh, that's never happened before. But yeah, you know, this dates back a long, long time ago, and with people like Paul Rader. Now, you mentioned radio. Paul Rader takes to radio, and that's a big growing phenomena too. And there's some other characters that harness a lot of this new technology, the era of urbanization where you can bring people into these big theaters. And two other looming characters come to mind that you talk about in your book. One is Amy Semple McPherson out there in Hollywood. And then another one is J. Frank Norris down there where you are now in Texas. Now, we've discussed the life and times of Sister Amy on a previous podcast with Matthew Sutton, and I'll link that podcast on our web page for those of you who want to check that out as well. You don't necessarily have to go into the details of Amy Semple McPherson's life, but I do want to discuss the trajectories of how, in many ways, these two individuals were resisting the cultural change of their time, but they were also entrapped by it. They became paradoxes of that era because Semple McPherson and Frank Norris, virtues of Paragon in their preaching, in their private life might have been something different.
Yeah. Well, Amy Semple McPherson, you know, is next door to Hollywood, and, you know, she's basically harnessing the popularity of entertainment and became something like, I mean, she's got all these nicknames. Sister Amy is her most famous nickname, and that's what she was called. But, you know, she was looked at also as kind of a religious version of Greta Garbo, a religious version of a movie queen, and she actually would have all these plays and sacred operas, she called them, and it was some Hollywood film critics and play drama critics said that her productions may be the best show in town, you know. So she very much was a sort of starlet, even a sort of religious flapper, you know, of the 1920s and incorporated all those sorts of things. Norris down here in Texas was a lot like Billy Sunday. He was about, their lives overlapped a good bit. Sunday died in the mid-30s. Norris died in the early 50s, so Norris was younger. Certainly Norris was modeling some of what he did after Billy Sunday, but Norris also pastored a huge mega church in Fort Worth, Texas. And for a time, he actually pastored two churches, one in Fort Worth, Texas, and the other in Detroit, Michigan. And he kind of flew back and forth, and he had lieutenants in each church, you know, these associate pastors that would run things when he wasn't there. But he became most famous nationwide in 1926 when he shot and killed a man in his own church office and was tried for murder. And it was a controversial sort of thing. The guy, Norris had been haranguing the local mayor of Fort Worth, who was Catholic. And Norris, like Billy Sunday, was anti-Catholic and anti-immigrant at the time. And so he actually was accusing the mayor of Fort Worth of misappropriating city funds for the Catholic Church. And one of the mayor's supporters called him on the phone and said, "You better stop doing this." And Norris had a newspaper where his sermons would appear every Thursday. So everything he said on Sunday appeared in his local newspaper on later in the week. And this guy, D.E. Chips was his name, came to Norris's office and threatened him. And there was good evidence in the trial that Chips had been drinking. And Norris pulled out the night watchman's pistol out of his drawer and shot and killed Chips right there in Norris's own church office. And
wow.
He was tried for murder, and he got off on self-defense. So, and his ministry went right on. He rebuilt. He didn't really even lose that many parishioners during all that time. So he was became known nationwide as a result of that, and then would continue controversially throughout the 20s, 30s, and 40s.
And again, it's interesting that he had these two ministries, one in Detroit, one down there in Texas, and you call them mega churches. We tend to think the mega churches has only been a phenomenon of the past 20 or 30 years here with Saddleback and Willows Creek and stuff, but Norris and Amy Semple McPherson and this Paul Rader guy has, you know, big, huge things drawing in hundreds, if not thousands of people all the time. And, you know, it's interesting how we say, oh, how will Christianity ever survive this mega church phenomena? But there you have Amy Semple McPherson doing these essentially Broadway plays in Hollywood with flying angels and the whole works.
Right.
Yeah. What happened to Sister Amy? Just for a brief reminder to those folks who did not hear our Sutton interview.
Yeah, the interesting thing, to preface this, some listening to this you're in my age may remember that 1976, when Jimmy Carter ran for president, was deemed by Newsweek magazine the year of the evangelical.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I call 1926 the worst year of the evangelical because that year, that's the same year that Norris was tried for murder, just 2 months before Norris shot and killed D.E. Chips, Amy Semple McPherson disappeared for a month. Resurfaced, disappeared in May, early May, and resurfaced in late June, and claimed she had been kidnapped and held by kidnappers in Mexico. But over the course of the next few months, as the DA in Los Angeles was investigating her kidnapping, and she had testified before a grand jury, the DA became convinced that she had lied about the whole thing, and it came to light that the same time she disappeared, her radio engineer had also, Kenneth Ormiston, had also disappeared. And so she actually ended up in court throughout the fall of 1926, which is the same time that Norris's proceedings are starting. Norris was not tried until January of 1927, but he was going through the whole pretrial proceedings and a change of venue and all that, at the same time that Amy Semple McPherson was being charged with perjury for lying to a grand jury. And eventually those charges were dropped, and she had to pick up the pieces and move on, and she did successfully. She, you know, her followers, she built her following back up just as Norris did. But it's interesting, and this was being followed, these two cases were being followed by all the secular newspapers, or most of the secular newspapers of the big cities. You can follow this in the New York Times on an almost daily, certainly a weekly basis, if not daily basis. You can read the New York Times or the LA Times and follow what's happening in the Amy Semple McPherson trial. And every now and then, interspersed will be stories about what's happening with the J. Frank Norris legal case. Mm-hmm. You know, and so these are two of the most well-known preachers. I mean, they're among several others, but they're two of the well-known preachers in America who are going through legal troubles at the same time. Yeah. One for murder, and one for probably adultery. So it's a really interesting time.
Yeah, it's interesting just to spring this forward and think about our times as well. I think of when I was reading those chapters, I'm thinking of Jimmy Swaggart and Jim Baker and all the, you know, they become big media superstars. They're harnessing the culture at the time, in many ways critiquing the culture at the time, but using that culture. And yet they get caught into this vortex, this pool of turbulence that really entraps them in many ways. So it's things we've seen before.
Exactly.
One of the other things that you do in your chapter or in your book, in a separate chapter that's really nice, is you talk about what's going on in black evangelical churches and African-American evangelical churches at the time. We oftentimes forget about that aspect. And you talk about two other preachers who have similar problems. I mean, you got the same kind of revivalism going on within the African-American community at this time, but also some of the same problems that occur. And briefly tell us about these two guys that you talk about. I love their names. That's why I have to bring them up here so I can put them in as our internet tags. Daddy Grace and Father Divine.
Yeah. Well, I want to just caveat to start with, these two were spectacular personalities that, again, like Norris and McPherson, had their own sort of controversies and, in fact, legal troubles as well. So they're by no means typical of black Christianity at the time, but they become sort of the mega stars, at least on the East Coast, for this. And both of them, I mean, they were both viewed as heretics by black preachers, by black evangelical, black Baptist, black Methodist, Episcopal preachers, you know, saw these two guys as real threats to Orthodox Christianity, because as their names would, Father Divine, I mean, actually claimed that he was God in the flesh, or at least some of his close followers claimed that, and he did not deny it. I think at one point he claimed it for himself. And then Daddy Grace actually came out of kind of a similar milieu that Amy Semple McPherson did, in that he came out of early Pentecostalism, and Pentecostalism originally was a black and white integrated sort of movement. It began to segregate in the 20s and 30s. But Daddy Grace came out of black Pentecostalism, and then he started his own ministry. It started in Massachusetts, but he actually started holding revivals in North Carolina and Georgia and places in the South. And he ended up founding these houses of prayer, and it became almost like a franchise operation. And over time, he became the exalted leader of this movement. Calling him Daddy Grace was not as unusual as one might think in black Christianity at the time. Calling the spiritual leader of a church Daddy or Father was not unusual. But what was unusual is that all of the houses of prayer, whenever Daddy Grace would show up, he basically would sit on a throne. First of all, they would start the service before he got there, and then he would come strolling down the aisle while people pressed dollar bills and into his coat pockets and so forth, and then he would ascend to a throne up on the platform. And the service would go on, and at a certain time, he would get up and do a little preaching. So it became a movement that exalted him as much as it did anything else. And then he got caught up in some legal difficulties in the 1930s, just like McPherson and Norris did. Both Father Divine and Daddy Grace ended up with communities. Both of them ended up in Harlem, which is really interesting, because Father Divine had a religious commune outside of New York City, a kind of a farm community, a farm co-op, and then he also moved much of it into Harlem, and so you had this large black religious movement in Harlem, and so Daddy Grace decided to move his operation into Harlem as well, almost, it seems, to challenge Father Divine. And the two of them almost competed. Well, they did compete with each other. Daddy Grace even bought one of Father Divine's buildings out from under. They both ended up owning all sorts of real estate in New York, upscale mansions, apartment complexes, storefronts, barber shops, all sorts of things. So it was a real phenomenon. Both of them had thousands of followers across the country as well as in their center bases. So really, really interesting sorts of things.
One of the things you just brought up with them is that these mega stars, the Amy Semple McPhersons, the Daddy Graces, they capture the spirit of the times in many ways, but they're not the only thing that's going on, that there's religious revivals that are occurring throughout America and in smaller churches with lesser known individuals. And there's also Christianity that's been moving, you know, along over the centuries and changing over time. And one of the things that we often forget when we focus on these cultural wars that pit the religious against the secular is that the religious folks, as well as the secular, they're not monolithic, and they oftentimes have fractions within them. There's tensions, there's rifts within each camp, and you do a really wonderful job of demonstrating this with respect to religion. And it's during the 1920s and possibly even a little bit earlier that we see this rift within American Christianity emerge that has a big impact for us today. Go ahead and describe what is happening between this division between the fundamentalist and the modernist.
Yeah. Well, again, it starts in the late 19th century, and by the 1920s, it's just an all-out pitched battle within the Northern Baptist Convention and within the Northern Presbyterian Church. At that time, Northern Presbyterian Church was still a separate denomination from the Southern Presbyterians, and both of them, you know, have modernism beginning, which is essentially the adjusting of Protestant theology to sort of meet the modern sorts of teachings of evolution and textual criticism of Scripture and these sorts of things. And then the fundamentalists are those who are defending the fundamentals of the faith and the what today would be called the inerrancy of Scripture and a literal reading of Scripture. And so by the 1920s, these are huge battles that are going on in these two denominations. And it's really, for a time, it's not clear who's going to actually capture the denomination. In both of those denominations, the liberal side ended up winning, and the fundamentalists either had to find a way to live within a more liberal denomination, or in many cases they split away from the Northern Baptist Convention or the Northern Presbyterian Church and formed their own smaller fundamentalist denominations. And one of the interesting things about this is these battles, they're all covered by the secular media. Again, you can follow these in the New York Times. Where every summer, when the Baptists meet, they have this battle between, on the one side, the liberal Baptists, on the other side, the fundamentalist Baptists, and the New York Times is following daily the meeting as it's going on, whether it's in New York City or Buffalo or Chicago or wherever. Same thing with the Presbyterians. And so it was really a part of the culture. Religion was central to the culture to the extent that the secular media paid close attention to it. And that's one of the things that, again, made me think about writing this book, is because up until 1980, you know, say from 1930 to 1980, you would not have heard, especially in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you would not have heard much about evangelicals in articles and news broadcasts about secular politics. But starting in the 80s and the 90s in our own time, you hear about the evangelical block of voters. And every time a political analysis is done, say in the Republican primaries of last year, one of the first things that's talked about is how will the evangelical vote, you know, go. And everyone knows it's going to go majority Republican, but how big is it going to go Republican? So I started, you know, thinking about from 1980 into our own time, or this period that I call our own time, religion is a central part of the culture, a central part of the political conversation. It was in the 20s as well. And with Prohibition, with the Scopes trial, with the denominational controversies that were going on. And something happened between 1930 and 1980, and this is, I hope to try and figure this out in another book someday, something happened where this sort of talk about evangelical religion in the mainstream of culture, in the mainstream of politics, just was not as prominent. In fact, it almost seems like evangelicals and fundamentalists went under the radar from 1930 to 1980 and then emerged again as a central feature of the culture, as had been the case back in the 1920s.
Yeah, that was one of the fascinating aspects of your book. You bring that up initially in the opening chapter, but also conclude with some thoughts on that. And I never really got a satisfying answer of what's going on here, because again, if to use an analogy, it really seemed like the pot of boiling water was turned up full during the 1920s. It had been bubbling a little bit in the 1880s, 1890s, but everything in the 1920s comes to a fruition. You know, 1926, worst year of the evangelicals, but you got all this other fermented denomination splitting, you know, just like we have today, the Anglican communities going in different directions. And it just seems as if everything is spinning out of control. And then all of a sudden in the 1930s, this disappears, and the 40s and the 50s. Do you think it might have something to do with, you know, say the other great economic problems that we're facing? You have the Great Depression and then World War II, which really requires a unified front of all Americans. So put aside these theological disputes and talk of evolution and all that other kind of stuff. And, you know, in the 50s, maybe just carried through with this. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. In fact, George Marsden, you know, leading scholar in my own field of religion and American culture, has essentially argued that the default, and I'm sort of arguing this in my book too, the default position in American history is sort of culture warfare and cultural conflict. But the period from 1930 to 1980 was anomalous. It was the unusual era for exactly the sort of things that you're talking about in the Depression era, and then especially World War II, and then the Cold War following World War II.
Yeah.
Really, the emphasis was on bringing people together and keeping controversial, divisive sorts of issues under wraps for the sake of the war effort, then for the sake of the Cold War, and so forth. And then once that begins to change, and the nation begins to move beyond that era, a lot of these same sorts of controversies that existed early on start coming to the fore once again. But there is another aspect to this as well, and that has to do with the Scopes trial. The Scopes trial, although the anti-evolution forces actually won the trial, it was viewed probably not right away, but starting in the 1930s, the way the Scopes trial was explained and discussed in literature, and it worked its way into the popular imagination, was that the Scopes trial was a major defeat for fundamentalism. And this idea that fundamentalism had been defeated became almost orthodoxy in the academic world, for example. You can read really good historical works, in fact, by Pulitzer Prize historians that wrote in the 1950s and 1960s, and they basically talk about fundamentalism and evangelical Christianity as something of the past. It's still around, but it's kind of just out there on the hinterland. It's not ever going to be a central part of the culture once again. So there was this view that, you know, the Scopes trial was symbolic of the fact that progressive modern culture had moved beyond fundamentalism, had moved beyond evangelicalism, and now we lived in a more enlightened sort of era. And so, but at that time, another scholar in my field has shown pretty convincingly that beneath the radar, fundamentalists and evangelicals were actually very active. The media just didn't pay any attention to them, and they didn't really want the media to pay any attention to them, but they were building colleges, Bible colleges, denominations, magazines, organizations, and so forth. So the infrastructure was actually being put in place for our own time after 1980, when evangelicalism and fundamentalism comes back into the center of culture and becomes a visible part of our sort of cultural, pluralistic, diverse sort of culture that we live in today.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I get a sense of that occurring in our contemporary era, that during the 1980s, you had the moral majority was on the rise and ascendant, and a number of other movements in the 80s and 90s. And it seems as if that has subsided maybe in the past 10, 15 years or so. But again, there's a lot of things going on undercover. And I know scholars who say, yes, secular culture always trumps Christianity and religious culture all the time. And we're living proof of that today. But they oftentimes forget about these cycles, or these constant, one side wins, the other side goes undercover and then reemerges at some other time. It just seems that what we saw from the 1920s through the 30s, 40s, and 50s is maybe perhaps happening today again.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of similarities. And I think one of the issues that started to come up in the 1920s that still bedevils us today is this public-private sort of issue. Is religion a public thing or is it a private thing? Well, you know, in some ways it's, you know, in one way it's private, another way it's public. And you started to have this in the 1920s with controversies over things like obscenity laws and whether and even in the Scopes trial, one of the most stirring speeches in the Scopes trial was done by one of the lawyers for the ACLU defending Scopes, in which he says, you know, the Bible's good, religion's good, but keep it in your home, keep it in your churches, keep it in your hearts. Well, at the time, that was the minority view, the idea that religion was supposed to be private.
Yeah.
Religion was very public. I think sometime in that 1930s and 1980, the sort of orthodox view was religion is supposed to be mostly private. But I think since 1980, although there are people that wish religion was private, it simply is not. It's very much a public part of our discourse and our culture. It just refuses to go into the private sector and stay there. And so we're not really sure. You hear both sides today. People who think, well, don't bring religion into public matter. Don't bring religion into politics. On the other hand, it's there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect it's going to be there in varying degrees throughout the foreseeable future.
What other things did you take away from your study of the 1920s that resonates with today? And this really gets to your last chapter of what we can learn from this culture war of the 1920s for our modern era. And one of the nice things that you mentioned, I fully agree with this, is how, you know, the default position in American history has been this cultural conflict. And I, you know, this morning on Facebook, somebody was saying, oh my gosh, the liberal Christianity is winning. We've never seen this in history before. And I'm like, you got to read history a little bit more. And it's the same thing. It's, oh, we've never seen our society is divided over culture so much as we are in the contemporary periods. And, you know, your book is a great antidote to that, to say, no, we learn a lot about what we are today by looking at what we were 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and even 1,000 years ago. So give us your thoughts, your reflections, having done this study of how you look at today's world.
Well, I think for one, history does not just move always in one direction. And this is something I think that we're starting to realize now. In the mid-20th century in America, I mean, that was the kind of the high point, kind of high noon of the Enlightenment progressive sort of view of history, which is that things always move from the less developed to the more developed, they always move in a sort of secular direction and so forth. And I don't think history moves that way. I think rather we see eras when certain things seem to be the norm, but that doesn't mean that the things that used to be the norm are gone forever. They tend to come back. And so this is one of the things I'm saying in this era 1930 to 1980, the norm seemed to be religion is going to be a private matter, and religion, to the degree that it is public, is going to be a sort of broad, liberal, civil religion that can really unite everybody. Well, for better or worse, and it depends on one's perspective, after 1980, that religion that had been prominent before 1930 comes back into the scene. It becomes central. It becomes divisive. It becomes controversial. It becomes very much a part of the conversation. And so it could go, you know, could go back in a liberal direction, could go back, you know, something completely different. So I think that's one, just the way we look at history. It's not a one-way street. We probably ought to expect the unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing is just to realize that this conversation about the role of religion in public life, it's never going to go away. And I think in that middle period of the 20th century, I think people thought, well, you know, we kind of had that conversation in the 20s, and we moved beyond it now, and so it's gone. Well, it's back again, and I suspect it's always going to be in our society, and that is, what is the role of religion? Is it private? Is it public? Should it have an influence on politics? If so, how? I think these are the sorts of things that were around before 1930. They're around again in our own time. They may become muted again in the future, but that doesn't mean that they're gone. I think this is, it's almost like religion and politics, religion and culture, it's a little bit like marriage. You never quite solve it, you kind of manage it, and expect to always have these sorts of tensions in our culture, and that's just the way it's going to be.
I think that is a wonderful lesson to leave off with. And for folks who are interested in our contemporary culture wars and perhaps might think that they're rather unique, I do recommend that they take a look at Barry Hankin's book, Jesus and Gin, Evangelicalism, the Roaring Twenties, and Today's Culture Wars, to get a wonderful historical perspective on this and to learn a little bit more about our times. And so, Barry, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.